Ladies and gentlemen, apologies for the wait. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I greet you with the greeting of peace. On behalf of the Islamic Society, I would like to warmly welcome you all to Discovery Week 2005, the grand launch with some free food. Before we continue, it's in our tradition to recite a few verses from the holy book of the Muslims, the Quran. I'll pass you over to Umar Al-Ghanim.
Assalamu alaikum and hello everyone. I'll be reciting verse number 255 of chapter number 2 of the Holy Quran.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الله لا إله إلا هو الحي القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
صدق الله العظيم.
I'd like to thank you all for coming to the first event of the great launch, which is about to unfold in the beginning of Discovery Week. And truly this is the beginning of a discovery. A discovery, the awareness and education of one of the largest faiths in the world today. Unlimited by land, by nationality, or race. Discovery Week is like a mini one week training course where there's no fee, you don't have to enroll, and there's no certificate at the end, of which the latter we could arrange for. Discovery Week, it's a form of providing some kind of religious education for those like ourselves that do not have access to at Imperial. And one of the aims of Discovery Week is that it may be for some who want to increase their understanding of Islam in their private study, or it might be a platform for those who want to clear up some misconceptions. Or it could be just for those who are curious. They might have some Muslim friends and would like to know more. But whatever it is, truly, Discovery Week is a learning experience, not from books, but from Muslims themselves. And the agenda for today, I know you're waiting for, is that we'll begin with the grand launch topic, followed by a short question and answer session, and then to end with what a few call the big munch. But to start it all off, we want to begin with our all-important question. A question that determines how and why we live. And that is the existence of God. Fantasy or reality? If you please allow me to introduce our speaker, he was born to British parents in 1964. He embraced Islam in 1988, and he now works for the London Cultural Centre and the London of the London Central Mosque.
Islamic Culture Centre.
Islamic Cultural Centre and the London Central Mosque. Without further ado, I'd like to invite the speaker to begin. And one piece of information, not that important, but I think the other thing is most important, and that is his name is Abdul Rahim Green. It was on the poster, by the way. So I thought you might remember that.
I have to put this in my pocket. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم Uncle Green إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا ما يهده الله فلا مضل له وما يضلل فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله We give our praise to Allah. We praise Him, we seek His help, and we ask for His forgiveness. And we seek refuge with Allah from the evil of our souls and from the evil consequence of our evil actions. Whomsoever Allah guides, there is none to misguide. And whomsoever Allah leaves to go astray, there is none to guide. And I testify that Allah alone is worthy of worship, and that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is the final messenger of Allah. Brothers and sisters, friends, I don't think that today, if you are familiar with the arguments and the discussions, intellectual ones and spiritual ones and philosophical ones, about how could we know that there is a God. If you are familiar with those, there probably will not be anything really new for you here today. Perhaps except the way that I might construct or put those arguments together. But I have a very firm, unwavering conviction and belief that the reality of the existence of a creator of this universe is the most simple, reasonable and rational explanation for the existence of our universe and for the explanation for the meaning and the purpose of our existence. But since I can see from the topics that lie ahead, I don't want to stretch myself outside the realm of the topic that I have been asked to talk about. So I'm really going to restrict myself to the rational arguments through which and by which we could prove the existence of God. And then I'm going to give some other arguments by which we could prove the existence of God. And I use this prove and I put my fingers like that to make inverted commas, because the first thing I would like to discuss with you is the concept of proof and evidence. Now, the books of philosophy that I have read discussing this issue and summarizing the various arguments that the philosophers have brought And it seems to be philosophers these days have come to a decision that we can't really prove that God exists, and that they're entitled, of course, to their opinion, which I don't really agree with. Having examined some of their counter-arguments and some of the reasons that they claim, what I have found generally is that they find it very easy to dismiss certain arguments, to put certain things forward in order to dismiss the very, very powerful and compelling evidence that is in front of us that this universe has been brought into existence by some great, wise power, some being, some intelligence. And the arguments that go against that, from my opinion, are very weak. In fact, it's strange that from people who claim to be rational, their arguments are often emotional. And I think it's a good time to introduce one of these emotional arguments from the beginning. One of the atheist's favorite arguments is an extremely emotional one. And it's been particularly brought to the highlight in the recent past with the tsunami. How could a God let such a thing like that happen? You have this tsunami, you have these disasters, you have these children dying, you have this pain, you have this suffering, you have AIDS, you have disease, you have war. How can there be a God? Actually, it's not a rational argument. It's not a rational argument. It's an emotional argument. The existence of these things say absolutely nothing about whether there's a God or not. That's the fact. The existence of these things has absolutely nothing to say about the issue of whether there is actually a creator of this universe or not. Why? Because the arguments that are always put forward about God's existence are based upon what we can observe of ourselves and our universe. The most compelling argument for me, of all, and the other ones fail to be sound convincing, is the argument of design. The argument that we live in a universe that is working according to laws, we find within it patterns, we find within it systems, and we find within the universe, the large universe, the cosmos, and also in the micro universe, the small things, we find incredibly intricate and complex mechanisms at work. We look at ourselves as human beings, our eyes, our brain, our lungs, our kidneys. We look at the world in which we live, the delicate nature of our planet, its distance from the sun, the alternation of the night and the day, the composition of the gases in the atmosphere. Each one of these things, if we examine them, are optimal for the existence of life. Oxygen is vital for our existence, essential for the existence of life. Yet too much oxygen can poison us. We find the perfect combination of gases, oxygen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen. There is a gas that protects us from the harmful from the harmful effects of the sun's radiation. We find our Earth alternates at a certain rate, 24 hours. Imagine actually if the Earth was rotating on its axis extremely slowly. Imagine that, for example, instead of a day being 24 hours, imagine a day was 5 or 6 or 7 years. What would be the effect of that? The effect would be one part of the Earth's surface would become superheated, the other would become supercooled. It would be inconceivable, difficult to imagine how life could exist under such conditions. If the Earth was much closer to the sun or much further from the sun, again, the conditions would not be right. And we find when we examine ourselves, when we look within ourselves, when we look at the human beings, when we look at the creatures around us, we find things existing And they are really amazing in their intricacy and their complexity. The human brain, an absolutely remarkable instrument. I once heard someone describing the computing power of the human brain, and they compared it to the world's fastest supercomputer at the time. In terms of the processing power of the human brain, if the human brain was represented by something like this drawing board, so that's about what, a meter squared, if we took it like this, a meter squared, the world's fastest supercomputer, its computing power was the size of my thumbnail, compared to the computing power of the human brain. These are the things that are very compelling. When we look at the laws which govern our universe, the stars, the galaxies, they are very compelling for human beings to believe that there must be some wisdom and some intelligence behind that. There is not one of us, not one of us, who would take seriously for a moment the proposition that a simple desktop computer or a simple mobile phone, or for example this MP3 player that has now been put in my pocket, was a product of chance and coincidence. Although the main elements of this instrument are two things, plastic and silicon, silicon being the chip that runs it. And what essentially plastic and silicon is what? Plastic and silicon, what's plastic from? Plastic is from oil. Silicon is, so name me a place where there's lots of oil and sand. Huh? The Middle East. So, I mean, yeah, that's good. You might get Iraq, Saudi Arabia, right? Something, whatever. So here I was walking along in the empty quarter in Saudi Arabia, and I found this lying on the ground, the product of chance and coincidence. Lots of oil, lots of sand. After thousands and millions and billions of years of the lightning flashing, the rain falling, the sand blowing, okay, this produced itself from a series of random events. I mean, all of us, no person would take such a thing seriously. We wouldn't. We just wouldn't take it seriously. And this is a relatively simple object compared to the human being. My point being, the argument is very compelling. It's rational. It makes sense. If we want to explain our existence, or the camel's existence, or the ant's existence, or the existence of everything in this universe, the simplest thing, a blade of grass, is extremely complex. The simple cell, the simple, the most simple living thing that we can think of, a cell, is fantastically complex. The information that needs to be contained within that, what we call simple, but it's not really simple at all, the information that it needs is astronomical. It is, in fact, inconceivable, immensely improbable and unlikely. And in fact, I believe it is really not something a rational mind can accept, that such a thing is a product of random events. Now, people would say, and we could give so many examples, we could be here all day giving more amazing examples, and I have so many in my mind, things that personally amaze me. One of them, for example, is the termites. How termites build their mound is absolutely incredible. How do these little creatures that have no brain, they have no computers, we can't even be sure how they could communicate with each other, yet they manage to build a structure that maintains itself constantly at a steady temperature of 30 degrees. They have an inbuilt air conditioning system. They grow their own fungus to feed themselves. The balance between the air coming in and they have a ventilation system. They have a series, they make from the earth rings down in the base of their tower. Down in the earth, they make these rings and they make channels so the air comes up through these rings and through. And how do they know to keep this whole huge structure at a constant temperature? How do they manage to produce such a feat of engineering? but by random events, by, you know, step by step, little bit by little bit. How? And since it's essential for their survival that this particular construction is maintained at that constant temperature, how did they survive before they were able to build such a thing? They don't have the capacity to gather that knowledge and that information. It suggests the logical, the rational conclusion would be that that information must have come from an external source. We look at our universe. We look at the universe in which we live. We don't ascribe to stars, to planets, to galaxies, the ability to organize. Yet they are amazing in the precision in which they are organized. Yet they don't have that ability to impose that upon themselves. How did it become organized? How did it reach this state? The universe does not have the capacity to organize itself. And we are not the creators of it. And did it come from nothing? Did this organization, this universe, come from nothing? Well, this is another question we have to ask ourselves. Where in the totality of human experience do we find something coming from nothing? Where? I mean, yes, a magician may pull a rabbit out of his sleeve and we all go, ooh. But we know it's a trick. He made us believe that he pulled something from nothing, but we know it's a trick. Because we know in reality, you don't get something coming from nothing. The more complex, the more organized, the greater the evidence of the intelligence and the wisdom behind that thing. That is why an archaeologist, can go into the desert. He can go into the desert, dig in the sand, and he can dig out one single piece of pottery. One piece of pottery. And he will tell us so many things about the civilization that made it. He knows about the materials they used. He'll be able to estimate the temperatures they needed in order to bake that clay, in order to get it to reach that consistency. And in order to do that, they must have been able to have this level of technology. And in order to fuel those ovens, they must have been able to access this type of fuel. And if there is writing and inscriptions on it and artwork, then he could tell us even more. He doesn't need to see the people making that thing. He doesn't even need to see the cities or the towns. He doesn't need to see that civilization. But for him, this piece of pottery is conclusive proof of the people who made it, of the wisdom and the intelligence behind it. This is the argument behind design. That this universe must have some wisdom and some intelligence behind it. Now, someone might object, well, that doesn't prove that there's a God. All that suggests is there's some wisdom, there's some... Maybe it could be a consortium of gods. Maybe it could be a company like Sony, you know, like you have all these, like, you know, things working together. Well, that's fine. But, you know, the point is, at least we reach the understanding that it is inconceivable and unreasonable and irrational to suggest that this universe and that we are a product of some random event of chance and coincidence. Now, something I want to bring in here is some people say, yes, it's not probable, but they say it's possible. Some people say, we agree. Many people will agree it's not probable. Even Richard Dawkins, who calls himself a secular fundamentalist, you know, I think he called one of his books Climbing Mount Improbability. I mean, he agrees that the proposition is improbable. But there's the agenda to push it forward that it is possible, it's conceivable. But, you know, there's something that confuses me here. How many people actually live their daily lives with such a philosophy? It is, of course, possible that you could come to Imperial College and do absolutely no work. Go to no lectures, make no attempt to study, never open a book. In fact, it is possible that you could not even read or write. And you could go into the exam, make some scribbles on a paper, and get a first. Yes? It's possible. Yes? But is that how you live your life? Does anyone live their life like that? There are a few people who go and pay the lottery, you know, and they think they're going to get money like that, you know. But I mean, in general, human beings do not live their life like that. They do not say, well, it's possible, remotely possible, therefore I'm going to pin all my hopes on that remote possibility. Be consistent. Be consistent, O atheist. Be consistent, O agnostic. If that's your attitude, have that attitude throughout all of your life. Why you only apply it when it comes to the existence of the universe and God? Because I'm sure, just like a student who spent their time at university, like how I described, at the end, he or she is going to have a very unpleasant surprise. Then surely, I will guarantee you, a person who has this attitude to this universe and to the being that has brought it into existence is going to have also an extremely unpleasant surprise. This is a really serious matter. By all accounts, if there is a God, this is not a joking matter, this is not a matter, it's not a casual matter. This is not a matter that we spend an evening thinking about it and, oh, that was a nice discussion. Because by all accounts, historically, from what people who believe in God and claim that this God has sent some revelation, by all accounts, they seem to agree that the consequences of failing to accept belief in this God and the consequences of failing to act in accordance to the dictates of this God are extremely severe. Therefore, everyone should take it seriously. Now, I wouldn't suggest that you take something seriously that's ridiculous. I mean, I don't really think people should take playing the lottery seriously. I mean, I don't play the lottery. And I think it's stupid to waste your money on it. Even if there is some remote possibility. But I don't think we're talking about a remote possibility. This is the point. The existence of God is not a remote possibility. It's an extremely logical and rational and sensible explanation for our existence and the existence of this universe. The atheist proposition is the improbable one. It's the unlikely one. The atheist is asking humanity to take a huge chance that this hugely improbable proposition might be the reality. So what the believers in God are asking is actually a sensible, rational proposition. Now, of course, I'm a Muslim, and I've chosen to be a Muslim, and I've chosen not to be a Christian, not to be a Hindu, not to be a Jew. I've chosen to be a Muslim. And like I said, I'm not going to go outside my framework today, and people are going to be covering in future lectures some of the reasons, I am sure, why we believe Islam is the truth. But my main focus today is on the issue of God. So I hope that we have at least touched upon the beginning of the idea of why the argument of there being some type of intelligence, some type of power behind this universe, behind ourselves, that has brought it into existence, is compelling. But that's not really enough. I'd like to go a little bit further than that. And I'd like to introduce some compelling arguments as to why there is only one such being, one God. And something also about the nature of this being. The first thing that I'd like to introduce is the idea or the question of the nature, something about the nature of God. What things can we know about this being? Okay, there is a compelling argument for design. There is a compelling argument there is something behind the creation of this universe. But what? And I've touched upon it already. I've touched upon the idea that, well, the universe itself, within itself, does not contain the prerequisites for being its own creator. In other words, it didn't come from nothing, and it didn't create itself. the universe being a collection of stars and galaxies. Now, we don't attribute to the stars and galaxies the ability to organize and systemize and create, but individually. We know of no individual star or galaxy that has that ability. And if they don't have it individually, how would they have it collectively? There's nothing to compel us, and there's no reason to make us believe that the universe together as an entity has the ability to create and organize and sustain itself. It's not an attribute that we ascribe to this universe. Therefore, the universe is not God. The universe cannot be God. In fact, I can't really see any rational reason to believe such a thing. In fact, I observe the universe, I observe you, I observe me, I observe the things in the universe, and I see these things need someone or something in order to bring them into existence and sustain them. They don't have that property themselves. They need something outside of themselves. The universe needs something outside of itself. There is another compelling reason to believe that the nature of God must be different from the nature of the creation. And that is because if the nature of God is not different from the nature of the creation, we actually don't have an answer to our problem. Our problem being, what is our problem? Here we have an organized universe. Here we have things within this universe working according to patterns and laws, delicate mechanisms. How did it come to be like that? That's our problem. Where did this knowledge, this information, this guidance, this systemization, where did it come from? Now, if the nature of God is the same as the creation, then in fact God is just another created thing. God, therefore, would be in need of the same explanation. If the creator is of the same nature as the creation, then we haven't found really an answer to our question. We can ask that question, the famous one, well, who created the creator then? And therefore it's very compelling for us that the creator must be different from the creation. The essence of the creator must be different from the creation. And someone may say, by the way, why couldn't we have a creator creating a creator creating a creator creating a creator ad infinitum? And the reason for this, there is a type of logical reason why that might not be possible, and we'd like just like to illustrate it with an example. If I wanted to lift this whole unit here, can't do it by myself, okay, so I ask Shahzad over here to help me. He says, oh, sure, I will help you, but I've got a condition. I will only help you if he helps me. And he says, yeah, and I will only help you if you help me. And the other one says, well, I will only help if he helps. And if everyone makes a condition that I will not help unless someone else helps, not very difficult to imagine, it sounds like an Islamic society, right? You know, I will do it if he does it, in a sense. So he should be used to that type of thing. So what happens if everyone says that I will help only if someone else helps? And if everyone makes that condition, what's going to happen? Nothing. Exactly. Nothing will ever get done. The table will never get lifted. Because as long as you have someone saying, I will help if someone else helps, and if someone else helps, then I will help, and everyone makes that condition, nothing will ever get done. This is to understand the concept. If there is a creator creating a creator creating a creator, it's the same scenario as lifting the table. If there's always something behind something behind something, then in fact what happens is nothing ever gets done. Nothing ever gets created. As the table is never lifted, the creation is never created. But here we are. The creation is here. That's a compelling reason to believe that there must be a first cause, a primary cause, something before whom there is nothing. And a being that is the first cause must be of a different essence, a different nature from the creation. So as the creation is temporary and finite and needy, those are attributes that we can convincingly and confidently give to the creation. It's temporary, it's finite, limited, and needy. it's confined by space and time. Therefore, it is not irrational. It is quite sensible. It's quite compelling to reason that the Creator must be infinite, self-sufficient, and not confined by space and time. So therefore now, we can confidently reason that there is an extremely wise, extremely powerful, extremely intelligent, I use that word cautiously, being that is self-sufficient, eternal, and not confined by space and time, infinite. Now, I usually sort of stop there and say, because I also find it very hard to be able to imagine, and I'm not saying it's not possible, but again, it seems to be the most likely of all choices from a reasoning point of view, that there could only be one infinite self-sufficient being. There are other reasons, compelling reasons, that we might think that there is only one such being, and that is also linked to, it goes back to the nature of the design of this universe. The nature of this universe, part, one of its characters is its symbiotic nature. The way that everything relies upon everything and everything interacts with everything else. There is a type of design within this universe that shows and illustrates a powerful single underlying force. This again compels us to the understanding that there should be one creator, one being that has brought this universe into existence. Now, I don't claim that that is a convincing proof, an absolute, unshakable argument that has nothing that someone can throw an objection against it. I don't mean that. But what I do believe is that this is a very, very compelling, very rational, very sensible belief. It's a very satisfying explanation for the existence of ourselves and for our universe. However, I think for some people it may be enough. For some people it may be enough. For others, they may need something else. They may need something more compelling. Or, it still begs the question, well, even if there is this God, what's that got to do with us? It, for some people, and there are people who believe that. There are people who believe that there is such a God. But what is the connection between God and human beings, if there is anyone? Why should God care about us? What are we? Just specks on an earth that's a speck in a universe that's a speck. But what is the universe? A speck before an infinite God. So why should God care about us? These are all important questions. They're all good questions. But I'm going back to my point about the atheist, the argument of the atheist. This, therefore, shows and illustrates why the argument of the atheist about the tsunami and AIDS and disease has actually got nothing to do with the existence of God. It's got nothing to do with the issue of whether there's actually a creator, one who has brought this universe into existence. What it does question, however, and we'll be honest about that, is it questions the nature of God. Why? Why does God let these things happen? Why does this creator, or why did this creator make the universe and make this world the way it is? Now, it's very interesting that when we look at ourselves as human beings, we look at ourselves as human beings, what we find is that there is not a need that we have. There is not a single need that we human beings have, except that we find that there is a means to satisfy that need. Think of any need that you have, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. Human beings have many needs. They're not only the need to breathe and to eat and to drink. We have many other needs. We have emotional needs as well. And we find that those needs have been met. In fact, often we find that not only have they been met, but they have been fulfilled generously, we could say.